And as blood glucose goes up, it circulates throughout the body. Obviously, your heart pumps the blood throughout the body and it circulates, and then it will reach tissues, one of the most important tissues of metabolism is something called the pancreas. The pancreas has cells called the beta cells. The beta cells are cells that actually allow glucose to enter the cell and detect the level of glucose relative to normal, normal being 70 to 120 milligrams per deciliter. If you can translate that to millimolars, but nonetheless, that's the typical range.
Hello, everyone. This is Vikas again, and you are listening to Run with Fitbidge. When we think of sport performances, we think of carbohydrate being our best friend, isn't it? We also think of that fat-adapted training could not be as efficient. When it comes to diabetes, on the other hand, it becomes an issue with carbohydrate consumption. Then we also talk about diabetes that is not type 2, that's type 1. There is another issue that starts to come, and it all starts to become complicated. Why I'm using these sentences is because all of this is so complex, isn't it? Actually, we make these things complex. I think there is a much easier way for us to live, for us to train, and for us to perform. What may be applicable to the Olympians, to the super elites, may not be for us. That is their profession, and that is not ours. Ours is, that is something else. We run, we do various sports for the love of it, isn't it? Why don't we then keep it uncomplicated and not try to copy similar to that of what the Olympians are doing or what a very high-level athlete is doing? Their physiology, their body, their training schedule, their adaptations are significantly different than ours. In fact, their priorities are very different than that of ours. We have our lives that are very different. And so in my opinion, our training should be as well. Our food should be as well. It should be simple, uncomplicated, and to demystify a number of things around very complex nutrition, life, sport performance, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Andrew Kotnik, who is an amazing researcher, who has been an outstanding athlete. If you look at his physique, if you look him up online, you will see who I'm talking about. He is an outstanding orator as well and has great command of whatever he talks. He makes sense and he makes a lot of sense. In the conversation today, I have the pleasure of speaking with him to discuss type 1 diabetes and, more importantly, discuss metabolic health, longevity of it, and what are different things we need to do to live a better life and rather an uncomplicated one. Let's welcome Dr. Kotnik to the show and be an informed runner, be a better runner, and be very good at whatever we do in general. Let's welcome Dr. Kotnik to the show. Dr. Kotnik, welcome to Run with Fitbidge. It's our weekly conversation where we have an opportunity to speak with established, decorated researchers like you. And today we are discussing all about type 1 diabetes more specifically. And I think it will add great value to our listeners listening from your experience, not only of being a researcher, but also living your life with type 1 diabetes.
Well, it's an honor to be here. I truly appreciate the opportunity. And it's been a life journey. You know, I've had type 1 diabetes now almost 17 years. Made it a life journey to study not only my disease, but also tools and strategies that apply to people beyond diabetes. So health and performance, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, exercise.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons it becomes very relevant to speak here today. I think from your experience of being also an athlete, living a very disciplined life yourself, being a researcher, it's a combination that is not very normal to find, and I think listening from you will add great value. But before we get to that, how about we start with an introduction of yours, your academic background, how and where did you grow up, and how did you move to becoming a researcher?
Yeah, let me see how quick I can make this. I started, my fascination and research started all the way back to when I was around 10 years old, not because I wanted to be a researcher at 10 years old, but because I struggled with obesity. I was, as a kid, I had obesity, and I tried everything to lose weight. You know, as a young kid, when you're overweight and obese, there's a lot of social stigma about weight, and it can affect your self-esteem. So I was always looking for a solution to try to fix that problem. Well, at that time, the major solutions, and still are the major solutions, were exercise, nutrition. And my family had always been very athletic. So my father had run marathons. My aunt and uncle had run numerous marathons, climbed mountains, did century rides, all sorts of, you know, athletic pursuits. And I was around that a lot. So that was kind of my focus, was exercise. But I also found that that didn't really quite work all by itself. You needed a dietary strategy to really push the needle and moving the weight. And so I eventually did lose that weight, but I became ultra fascinated in the tools and strategies of lifestyle. How does nutrition, how does exercise affect how you feel? And it took me quite some time to find success, but I did eventually lose the weight. But then a year later, completely unconnected with my weight loss or seemingly the other factors involved in my journey up to being fascinated with health and nutrition, I get diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 16 years old. And actually was on a family trip and had no idea what was going on. Luckily, my grandmother was a nurse, so my mom had called her. I got very sick, ill. I was urinating a lot. I threw up for 14 hours straight. All the telltale signs of diabetes, but also telltale signs of other things like flu or cold. So a lot of people often get confused, and it can be very deadly very quickly if you don't actually catch it. So luckily, my grandmother was a nurse. My mom had called her and said, look, he's thrown up for 14 hours straight. We tried everything. It's not working. She said, take him to the hospital. So I went to the hospital. My blood sugar was, just to give context, normal blood sugar levels range 70 to 120 milligrams per deciliter. My blood sugar was 596. And so it was five times what normal was. And so, yes, it was. And they were like, hey, your blood sugar is 596. You have type 1 diabetes. I had no idea what this meant. You know, I had no clue what the implications of this would be for the rest of my life. But for your audience, in that moment, what had been happening to my body was that my body's immune system was attacking the pancreatic beta cells that produce insulin that ultimately regulate glucose levels. And we can talk more about that. But ultimately, that made every journey I had with trying to regulate obesity and become bigger, stronger, faster with nutrition, exercise, it took it to a completely different level, because type 1 diabetes is the ultimate insight into your own metabolism. Over anything else, I would argue, as a disease, it gives you almost complete understanding of what's going on in your body, because you're manually manipulating insulin and affecting glucose, and you see all the values every day as you manage your disease. And that made me extremely passionate about that topic on a whole nother level. And that's really, I essentially could not turn back on the path to doing everything I could to understand health, lifestyle, nutrition, exercise, and how they ultimately affect, you know, well-being. I then go into college, study exercise science at Florida State University. I did research there on cardiovascular health and also psychological health, how psychological health affected cardiovascular health, and some other projects as well. But then I went on to grad school to study how nutrition affected disease because of my personal journey. I wanted to because my whole journey at this point, transparently, was a passion-driven project to understand the things I had seen happen in my life and understand what's actually happening. Does it apply for in other contexts? And so when I went to University of South Florida College of Medicine, I worked under a gentleman named Dr. Dominic D'Agostino, who had studied low-carbohydrate diets for things like cancer. And I had, at this point, also gone on a personal journey with studying nutritional interventions to manage my diabetes, well beyond just, you know, trying to lose weight. And we studied ketone bodies, we studied low-carbohydrate diets, And then I went on to actually work with, after I graduated, I went on to work as a principal investigator or a researcher at an institute called Institute for Human and Machine Cognition. The Department of Defense in the United States was very interested in ketone bodies and or metabolic therapies to improve performance of the warfighter. And so we worked to understand some of these tools in that context in actual human studies in unique extreme environments. And from there, all in the backdrop, I was continuously passionate about trying to move the needle in diabetes because I have this disease. You know, when you wake up every single day and think about what do I want to do with my life, it was very, you know, I wake up every single day with a disease that affects almost every waking moment I have. And I knew that I wanted to really make a difference in that disease. And so I essentially transitioned and fully committed to studying that in the context of diabetes or people at risk for diabetes. That includes obesity, prediabetes, type 2. But obviously, I live with type 1, and so it's cornerstone to my passion. And I'm at Sansum Diabetes Research Institute, where our main central focus is understanding not only the disease of diabetes itself, but how can we apply tools and technologies to help improve the lives of people living with this disease. So a long story to say, it all really started from obesity, getting diagnosed with type 1, studying exercise and nutrition, cardiovascular health, to moving all the way to where I am now and focusing primarily and almost exclusively on how do we improve the lives of people with diabetes.
Thank you. Thank you for a great introduction. And this also puts things in context where we are going and what we are going to discuss. Also, to give you a little more understanding of what we do, from a fitness point of view, we propose cardiovascular fitness over everything here in India through the application. And this was one of the reasons why I left my previous job working for an investment bank and then media house, primarily to look at can we see that movement becomes not really a medicine, but a way of life if people can move a little more. Because if you see in India, obesity has been so prevalent, and so has been all metabolic disorders. And we've seen over a period of time that it is helping people significantly by just simply walking. One of the things we always look at is being surprised at how our education system does not allow for us to study even elementary information about exercise physiology, about basic exercise science, about fitness at all. Like in India, primarily we grow up and we study with an academic interest to get a job, not to study something that will help us live fitter, for example. And so at a later stage, when people get diagnosed with some of these, or even if they are not diagnosed because they don't know, but up until very late stage, and in many cases, they don't even get to know about these conditions because of unavailability of symptoms, etc., they just get trapped because they're not aware how to address it. And when this comes, it hits them, they are either in denial, or if they want to respond, they try to resort to certain shortcuts, etc., and none of those help most of the time. So we decided to try and see if we can do our bit to get people to move a little more. And so it was very heartening to see when you started to talk about cardiovascular health and the impact of psychological health into cardiovascular health. It's just so important as well. And maybe we can talk about those too, but I do not want to digress. I want to stay close to diabetes because that's one of the most important topics that needs addressing, that needs more discussion. India is now the diabetes capital of the world, unfortunately, and with the way it's growing, I feel it's a catastrophe. And I do not want to sound scary, but this is how it is going, if you ask me. So why don't we take it from the very base and help people understand what happens when we consume carbohydrate or when we consume food? What is the role of pancreas? How do they work? What do they do with the insulin, for that matter? And then when is that point when one turns diabetic or not, for example?
Yeah, and I will resonate with many of your points. It is a growing epidemic that is of major consequence to many people and cannot be ignored. So I don't think I think what you're saying is very accurate. and a great reflection of what many countries are dealing with, unfortunately. When we talk about diabetes, the best way to describe it is just to look at it from a big picture perspective. There are more than one type of diabetes. The one that most people are aware of is type 2 diabetes. So when someone eats carbohydrates, let's say bread, other foods that rice, pastas, any of these type of foods, when you consume them, they go into your stomach and there are enzymes and acidity in your stomach that break the carbohydrates in these individual polysaccharides, monosaccharides. These are basically precursors to be broken down into what will become glucose. Your body absorbs these through the intestine, and then ultimately they make it into the bloodstream. Now, when they make it into the bloodstream, of course, the blood, you heard of blood glucose, it's now when more blood enters it after you consume it, blood glucose goes up. And as blood glucose goes up, it circulates throughout the body. Obviously, your heart pumps the blood throughout the body and it circulates, and then it will reach tissues. One of the most important tissues of metabolism is something called the pancreas. The pancreas has cells called the beta cells. The beta cells are cells that actually allow glucose to enter the cell and detect the level of glucose relative to normal, normal being 70 to 120 milligrams per deciliter. If you can translate that to millimolars, but nonetheless, that's the typical range. And when it goes above those ranges, the body works very, very hard through these beta cells to keep it in normal range, because there's major consequences for it being low or too high to our health. So what the pancreas does when it sees, hey, all this glucose is in the bloodstream, we need to bring it down into normal levels because it can cause harm if it stays up high, your body will release insulin. Now, and someone else who doesn't have diabetes, there's these stored granules of insulin that are instantly released into the hepatic portal vein. That means the liver. And it instantly hits your bloodstream. So immediately as your blood glucose comes up, your beta cells detect it, immediately trigger releases of insulin straight into your bloodstream. We're talking seconds to minutes, it's going to hit it. When that happens, the insulin will go around the tissues, bind them, and open up these receptors that allow glucose to enter the cell and be utilized as energy or for storage. Now, that's how it's supposed to work. You eat food, your blood sugar goes up, your body releases insulin. Insulin's the most powerful hormone, arguably, in the body that helps bring that glucose into the cells for energy or storage for later. But what happens when, let's say, you have too much, or your body has become resistant to the amount of, let's say, over time you're eating food, you're gaining weight, your lifestyle has led you to become, let's say, obese, and all of a sudden you start noticing your blood sugar is getting higher and higher. Well, what is happening through a number of mechanisms is your body is, one, having a hard time actually taking the insulin that's being released and actually allowing glucose to come into the cell. One could argue this is because of an excess or an overabundance of energy availability. So it becomes insulin resistant. So your body is no longer able to take the insulin that it once was utilizing to open the cells and provide energy, and now it's becoming resistant to that insulin. Well, what happens when you become resistant to the insulin? Your body's pushing out more. So you have more insulin in the system. Even despite having way more insulin in the system, your body still can't completely control the glucose because it's resistant to the insulin being administered. So blood glucose stays high and more variable in response to food. Well, in the context of carbohydrates are the most potent effect on glucose out of anything else that can be consumed compared to protein or fat. So obviously carbohydrates will rapidly elevate glucose levels. And if it's not able to be metabolized into the cells, it of course leaves higher and higher glucose levels within the circulation. That's type 2 diabetes. Over here on type 1 diabetes is the absence of insulin. So everything is framed in these two types of insulin, type 2 and type 1. Type 2 is insulin resistance, and type 1 is insulin deficiency. So there's an autoimmune attack. So your immune cells detect your beta cells as foreign. It destroys them. So you no longer have insulin being produced. And this type of diabetes ultimately also results in high variable glucose levels and insulin resistance. So the main outcomes of both disease, even though they look very different, is actually very similar. And this leads into a point you brought up, which is the number one cause of death for both of these types of diabetes that are most prevalent is cardiovascular disease. And this is the primary focus of why we want to control things like blood glucose or insulin. So again, type 2 diabetes is the development of insulin resistance. Type 1 is the absence of insulin. And that's really the distinguishing component between these two types.
Got it. And now I have a couple of questions from here. So one is, as we consume food, and after that, there is an insulin response. And so we are saying the glucose level keeps rising. In regular conditions, we will see people that the number is between 70 to 120. Do you think even within this, it can be at the upper range of, say, around 120, and that is still fine? Or if someone is noticing that earlier it used to be around 80, for example, HbA1c for the last 3 months, it was, say, 5.1, for example. And over a period of time, if it has increased to become 5.3, does it mean that it's getting closer to pre-diabetic level and we should start to get now a bit cautious and start to notice what we are eating and how we are living?
That's a great question, one that is very much a hot topic right now. There are diagnosable levels of glucose levels that tell someone if they have pre-diabetes. So if someone's going from the normal range of HbA1c, which is basically a measurement of how much glucose has been around for an extended period of time, because that glucose binds to red blood cells and you're actually detecting the amount of red blood cells with glucose bound to it. So that's called HbA1c or hemoglobin HbA1c. When HbA1c gets higher and higher, it is a reflection of more glucose binding to hemoglobin. But you also have to appreciate that a lot of these tests are not perfect, meaning that if you were to do an HbA1c test on one day versus another day, you may have had the same amount of glucose levels over the last 2 months, but there might be some variability in these measurements. So as a result, the diagnosis for prediabetes is 5.7% or higher. So 5.7% to 6.4% HbA1c. And then there's also diagnosis for fasting glucose levels. So 100 to 120, give or take range, is prediabetes. Actually, 124. If you go higher than that, you'd get diagnosed with full-fledged diabetes. And then you have other things like oral glucose tolerance tests. But in essence, what all these are telling you is that more glucose is in your blood. And more glucose is in your blood is a reflection of what they call a pathological process that is developing. So if blood glucose levels are getting higher and higher and higher on average over the day, that is a reflection of something that is going on within your physiology or your metabolism that may be worth paying attention to. Most people would say that if you're not in the prediabetes range, this is of no concern because you don't have anything that's diagnostic. You're in the healthy range. But there is an open ongoing discussion about how we prevent the development of metabolic disease before it even happens, right? And if you notice that you're moving in the wrong direction, most people would say, don't pay attention to that. Don't induce anxiety over that. Don't worry about that. And that's a good argument. But there's also an argument that to be said that, well, should we ignore that? If we're progressing and you see elevations in blood glucose levels, do we want to wait until we see a full diagnosis? Because once that happens, there's already a process that has taken place within the body that has led to that level getting higher and higher. Wouldn't you want to capture it here, address it as soon as possible? Of course, because prevention almost always is the most powerful tool. Once you get to the point of full-fledged diagnosis of any of these conditions, it is very, very hard to reverse them because there's the accumulation of metabolic changes and pathology in the body. We can talk about that, but ultimately leads to it being very difficult to turn the clock back on the damage that could have been done. So the numbers you're describing of 5.1 to 5.3, they all fall in the healthy range. But if someone's seeing a progressive elevation in HbA1c over time, they should be paying close attention, I believe, on their health and wellness and maybe taking a really deep look at their lifestyle and what they can do to improve it.
Sure. Thank you. The second question related to this was, we talked about carbohydrate consumption primarily, and that is That is one of the reasons for us to see a glucose spike, for example, in the bloodstream. Do you think there is a stress response as well that causes for the glucose level to rise in the bloodstream?
There is. There's well-known stress hormones or molecules that are released in response to stress. So let's say you're about to go give the most important talk of your entire life. There'll be thousands of people listening and you're, you know, terrified, or you're right before one of your biggest races. You train for months and months and months on end, and you're concerned about how well you're going to perform. All of these can lead an internal response to elevate stress. And when your body perceives or sees stress, it can release molecules like cortisol, glucagon, epinephrine, norepinephrine that ultimately can go to your liver and actually cause the release, specifically glucagon, can trigger the release of these bound glucose molecules called glycogen and release them. Typically, glycogen is supposed to be there in response to hypoglycemia, so low glucose levels, in a, let's say in the fasted state or in famine, you know, historically, evolutionarily speaking. But they're also there to help release glucose if you're under a very stressful environment. Let's say the joke people usually say is when you're running away from a dinosaur or something, you know, you would have this high stress response. You've released glucose. You're what they call liberating energy into the blood that can be utilized. So yes, both can do that. And it's not uncommon to see that. In fact, one of the most common ways to induce it is doing max effort sprints. Or you can go into an extremely stressful lifestyle event, or you can do extremely high intensity, max intensity sprints. Let's say you do a 30-second max sprint and you do five of them with a little bit of rest in between. You'll see elevations in blood glucose levels, which are completely normal. That is, there's nothing wrong with that elevation in glucose. It would be concerning if every day you go into a lifestyle or an event that causes a level of stress where you're constantly seeing elevation in glucose as well, but not from healthy stress like exercise, but from environmental stress that's not positive.
Got it. Thank you. Moving forward, since most of our listeners are recreational or serious athletes, primarily endurance athletes, their questions are generally around carbohydrate consumption and its role in training during, pre, and before, and after. And what I learned so far in the last 20 minutes that it does not seem like carbohydrate is the best friend. And I'm not saying I'm totally not saying that it's not the best friend for the body or for our energy. I'm saying from the point if it's in excess, it doesn't help. Now, when we as runners look at energy gels or chews or number of other energy supplements, we start to get happy that these are going to become our energy aids during a long run. How, as an athlete, do I look at then carbohydrate consumption from that point of view? And then we could possibly, at a later stage, talk about if I am, say, type 1 diabetic, in that case, how do I look at energy consumption during, before, and after training?
You are asking a very controversial question. I don't think it's very controversial in the traditional sense, but I will talk about it in a way that I think will be viewed maybe a little bit differently than maybe some of the prior speakers have spoken about, or maybe some of your audience has heard about. In the context of diabetes, elevation in blood glucose levels and sustained high and variable glucose levels are very problematic. You know, there's no doubt about that. That causes major cardiovascular disease and what they call microvascular diseases over time. But what about an athlete? You ask the question, what should an athlete do? What's the role of carbohydrates in an athlete's life? Well, there is an important role, right? It's well established that the traditional thinking is that carbohydrates are critical fuel for high-end exercise performance. And there's a lot of evidence for that. There's also a lot of evidence, let's say if you do something like a ketogenic diet, that it may impair performance. However, let's unpack that a little bit. So most of the studies that have shown an impairment in performance with low carbohydrate diets have historically focused on very short duration diets, let's say 1 to 3 weeks. It's important to appreciate that when you undergo a very low carbohydrate diet, there's a metabolic adaptation that your body is going through to start utilizing fat as your primary energy source over glucose. Your body is lowering insulin levels. It lowers glucose levels first, then insulin levels come down. Insulin levels come down actually is the main trigger of changing the enzymatic processes within the body to start liberating more fat from your adipocytes, to allow for fat oxidation to be higher, to allow for ketogenesis to occur. And you're basically switching your metabolism over to fat. There's also changes in hormones. There's changes in mineral load that all accompany that, that don't happen immediately. It takes time. It happens over, frankly, weeks. And so what you see in the literature is this evidence that says, well, no, low carbohydrate diets impair performance. But actually, if you look at all the studies ever done, and you look at all studies ever done that are at least 4 weeks or longer, when we see a lot of the metabolic changes start to reach homeostasis, there is no difference in performance between these very low carbohydrate diets and these high carbohydrate based diets, that at least over the weight of the evidence, meaning if you look at all studies ever done, there might be a study over here that shows a positive effect, a study over here that shows a negative effect, a study right here that shows a neutral effect. You take in all those studies. If it's over 4 weeks in duration on the diet, again, because it takes that long to adapt to many of the processes within the body, you see signs of no differences, meaning you could do either, you could do whatever you wanted. And that brings up an open question. And I'll talk about one study we did that I think is relevant to your audience. We took middle-aged athletes around 40 years of age who had, you know, very fit. They ran 50 kilometers per week, had super high VO2 maxes, were very lean, so low body fat. And we put them on continuous glucose monitors. What we wanted to do is we wanted to capture insights into not only their cardiometabolic health by looking at insulin and HbA1c, but we also wanted to capture the moment-by-moment nuance in glucose. And what we found is that in these athletes that were consuming either a high carbohydrate diet for 4 weeks or a low carbohydrate diet for 4 weeks, or a very low carbohydrate diet, so less than 50 grams per day, what was the impact on their metabolism looking at continuous glucose monitoring and other cardiometabolic outcomes? But what was their performance outcomes? And what we found is, one, there was no difference in performance after 4 weeks. This is actually not the first analysis to show this. There's been many analyses that have shown that if you go on this diet for over 4 weeks, there is no difference in performance. We also found, which was very striking and interesting to us, that in the athletes, 30% of them on a CGM on a high carbohydrate diet showed the signs of or blood sugar levels that were consistent with prediabetes. These athletes did not know that. When they switched to a very low carbohydrate diet, again, it didn't impair their performance, but they were able to completely resolve those blood glucose levels into levels that were no longer consistent with prediabetes. They were normal. What this told us is that these individuals were completely unaware of a metabolic phenotype that appeared to be occurring, but it was able to be resolved through understanding of what was happening with their metabolism and then resolving it with strategies like nutrition without impairing their performance. So this really leads to the bigger open-ended question is, if we know that the weight of the evidence says that over 4 weeks in duration on a diet, there's really no difference across these dietary strategies if you adhere to the diet for long enough, but we know there are health implications for things like risk for prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, that diet has impacts on that. And then maybe there's a consideration of maybe we should be making choices around not performance, because it doesn't seem to matter if you're on it long enough, but what about your health? And that really is an important point that I think is often pushed to the side by many in the traditional community, but is frankly very real. And it needs to be discussed, because the average person in the United States, and as you're describing the epidemic that's happening in India, isn't a healthy person. We're talking about the vast majority of people in the United States, at least, are unhealthy. They're overweight or obese, up to 70 to 75%. And the majority of adults in the United States have prediabetes, and 80% don't even know it. Yep. So this is an important conversation that must be considered on health as well.
Yeah, indeed. Now, it's such an interesting point that you mentioned. I've gone through some of those researches, and it has gotten me to be very curious, and I wanted to maybe seek your help to address. That is, when we think of utilization of fat, or fat adapted training, for example, we start to think of fat is not as efficient use of energy source. And there has been umpteen literature around it. Now, what would you say in this case, in case people have been on a low carbohydrate diet for 4 weeks or longer, that clearly means that they are starting to get onto a fat adaptation a lot better now, and they are using that as an energy source. So how would you suggest, is it then not the case that the fat is not as efficient, for example?
So from a biochemical perspective, Louise Berg has done a lot of this work with a lot of her colleagues, looking at the, all the way down to the molecular, more of a molecular reductionist lens on what is more efficient, just raw math. And the case has always been made that fat is less efficient, especially for high-end performance. That said, when you actually look at the studies that actually look at performance across these different dietary strategies, you do not see a difference. So there's a disconnect here, right? So there's this idea that on one end, everything says that it should lead to worse performance, but if you adapt to it and adhere to it for long enough, doesn't seem to really matter. Well, when we were doing our studies, what we had found is that, well, let me back up for a second and make sure the audience is aware of this. There's a traditional understanding in exercise physiology that as you go higher and higher in intensity of exercise, that you start to utilize more and more carbohydrates and less fat. And it was believed that around 60 to 70% of your VO2 max is where you shift as you go higher and higher towards almost completely glycolytic energy use. Not entirely, but overwhelmingly, right? And then fat use goes down almost to nothing. Well, we had done a number of analyses actually looking at that exact effect. And what we were finding was that we were seeing that individuals at 85% of their VO2 max, so well above this, what they call the crossover point in physiology, where fat use would be almost zero and carb use would be extremely high, that actually when someone adhered to a very low carbohydrate diet for at least 4 weeks in duration, who were athletes, highly competitive, fit, high VO2 maxes, that they were able to see record levels of fat oxidation, so north of 1.5 grams. And that is remarkable, right? It's basically illustrating that people are able to still utilize fat, even at very, very high VO2 max levels, and do so. And that appears to make up the difference, metabolically speaking. So if you're relying on glucose, but you're not taking it in or utilizing it as a primary fuel, you'd think you'd, of course, perform worse. But emergent evidence is from our group and others has clearly shown that you're actually using way more fat during these higher and higher levels of exercise intensity than were ever once thought to be possible or occur. And so I think there's some rethinking that needs to be done. However, I also want to acknowledge that there's another case that is made that, okay, well, a lot of these athletes are going well above 85% of their VO2 max at the elite level. Well, That is true, right? So they are going much, much higher. And that's an open-ended question because a lot of those studies in very elite athletes are 3 weeks or shorter in duration. So we're really missing the opportunity to look at that from a much longer duration. Now, Jeff Volek at Ohio State University, who's kind of been in this space and done low carbohydrate research for multiple decades, looked at some of the highest performing endurance athletes in the world who had habituated to a high carb diet or a very low carbohydrate ketogenic diet. Now, he didn't test performance differences, but what he did look is just the metabolic differences between these two cohorts. And what he found is that these very low carbohydrate dieters, again, had record levels of fat oxidation. So it appears that the fat oxidation levels actually are, in fact, compensating for that change. What this teaches us from a human physiology perspective is that your body will do almost anything it needs to adapt to what you give it, right? Teaches us that the body will adapt and do almost anything it needs to adapt to what you give it, the demands that you're applying to it from exercise, nutritionally speaking. And sometimes it can't always adapt. Let's in this context of type 2 diabetes, when you're over consuming and then it leads to pathology. But nonetheless, yes, it is. To your question, yes, there is a lot of conversation about this very acute perspective on efficiency. But when you actually look at the evidence in individuals, there's a neutral effect over 4 weeks. So there is a timeline component to it. And there's also this gap in literature on the very top end on long duration adaptation, outside of knowing that high performing athletes who've been on these diets for a long period of time versus those who are on high carb have distinct metabolic phenotypes, like completely different from one another. But we don't know how that translates to performance. The assumption from most in the community is they would perform worse. But we don't have that evidence to support that. And I also think it's really important to understand that when people talk about performance, there a lot of the researchers in the field are focusing on the elite level performer, like the absolute top 0.01% or 0.01%. That is not 99% of the people out there. That is not discussed, okay? That's very, very important, because what happens in an elite athlete is not what's happening in the people who are typically listening to this podcast, the vast majority of them, although you probably have some elite athletes who do listen to it. They're not the same person. They don't typically have the same metabolism. What I'm talking about here is what is applicable to that, seemingly applicable to that 99%. There is an open question about that top 1%, or frankly, 0.01%, who are truly elite and what they are doing to perform. But when someone's looking for guidance on what they should do for their life and what they should do for their performance, that not only integrates their performance they want to see out when they exercise, but also their health and wellness, that's a different conversation. Okay. And with the vast majority of people being metabolically unwell and unhealthy, we need to be having serious conversations of how much we should be advising people to do what has traditionally been taught, and or should we consider other approaches that may be very powerful tools in regulating things like the growing obesity epidemic or the growing incidence of type 2 diabetes, and incorporate that as one of the mainstays or main tools that we can utilize in managing these major problems.
Right. Yeah. And this is a very important point that you mentioned about applicability of what's being done at the elite level to the normal people. And it always got me wondering, and I'm just so excited to see that you are resonating with it as well. I almost am not able to fathom most of the times that you will see the replication of any of the tests, any of the researches that are done on the very elite level to the society, to the common people who may not even resonate with it physiologically, socially, psychologically, economically, and in many other ways. I feel they are totally different. And yet there is a similarity drawn in a way that if it works for the very elite level, it will work for you as well. Which I totally think is not the case. For example, if there is a particular shoe that you see someone is going and winning an Olympics gold medal, if a normal obese and overweight person wears it and does a sprint of even 100 meters, will be injuring themselves right away, for example, right? And so I think none of these marketing gimmicks or the research context that are taken in the right parallel, in my opinion. And there has to be something very significant that needs to change at the helm of decision making for these nutrition interventions, for these possibly wearables, clothing, shoes, all of these. Because I start to wonder whether the normal sedentary office going person who's possibly even low on confidence, who's obese or overweight, need to focus on just getting 30 minutes, 40 minutes of workouts done, or focus on getting the $300 minimum of a shoe to start walking, for example, right? And so I think that's a decision you and I can talk forever.
Yeah, I want to, this is maybe the most important point in the entire discussion we're having today, which is everyone wants to look at that the best in the world. What is the best in the world doing? Because obviously they got to the best. They must know what they're doing. I must follow that path to be what they're doing. But what they have done over time is they started all the way down here. I don't know if people can see this, but they started at a very years and decades before that. They were doing simple things, simple steps, one step at a time, to the point where they built on those steps to where someone who's, you know, running the fastest marathon in the world, or someone who's running the fastest ultra marathon, or, you know, the best basketball player, the best soccer player, they have been building up so much volume, time, intensity, all these other factors that the average person is nowhere near. If you were to jump to the calories that these people were eating and eat their same diet, if you were to jump to the same exact amount of time that they're exercising every single day, you would instantly injure yourself. You would become pretty obese quickly. Like the reason they're where they are is because they took one step and then two steps, then three steps. And before you knew it, they were running miles and miles and miles building on what they were trying to get to. And when a lot of the audience that we're speaking to here today, or the average person who's dealing with, you know, the common health crises and other issues that come along with, you know, metabolic health, mental health, and everything along with that, because we are in an epidemic and we are in a crisis when it comes to that, you have to be very careful to look at that top 1% and what they're doing. You can go walk outside with no shoes. Okay. You don't need an elite level. You don't need elite level tools or gimmicks, all these other things. Don't get me wrong. Like, they may help a little bit. But again, showing up every single day, just getting 30 minutes, like you said, of just going out and walking, it's one step. Before you know it, you might be walking 31 minutes, 32 minutes. You know, you might get to an hour walking. And then you say, okay, man, I feel great. I've lost some weight. I start to feel better. I'm healthier. Like, I feel better at work. I can think better. Maybe you start to like run a little bit. Maybe you run like 5 minutes on, 10 minutes off, 5 minutes on, 10 minutes. Before you know it, you're becoming fitter and fitter and healthier and healthier. But the most important thing to do is do the one thing that you feel you can do sustainably just to improve your overall health. And usually that is just walking, going out and walking for 30 minutes a day and just getting physical activity. Do something that you enjoy, you know, do something that makes you feel better and give it a shot for at least a week to a month. I guarantee most of these people won't feel worse. They'll probably feel better. But yes, if you look to the best in the world for advice let me put it this way. If you look to the best in the world and try to copy what they're doing, I guarantee you, you're setting yourself up for failure. You're not that person. Doesn't mean you can't be that person, but it's one step at a time. And generally, that means just starting very, very slow and taking incremental steps to improving your overall health.
True, true. And I guess one also has to decide whether it is your priority to be like that, or you are just getting inspired by looking at them. And so you want to become that, but people need to understand that they're professionals in what they're doing. Our professions are possibly not that. It is just possibly a way of finding another hobby that is getting us to be fitter. And so possibly that's where we should be keeping at it instead of thinking of it as a full-time profession. And if that be the case, then there can't be two or three full-time professions. We have to see what is a priority for us. And just one small anecdote, rather two. One is in our programs that we run, and it's not at all a marketing intervention here in the middle of the podcast, but we run a walk to weight loss program, which is 100% free for all the people on the app. And what we do is we audio record in different languages where people can simply put their audio phones and start walking. If they stop, it asks them, hey, have you stopped? Why have you stopped? Sip of water. Basically, very, very small nuggets of information that will help them keep taking their steps of, say, 4,000, 3,500 steps in 30 minutes or something like that. And the amount of feedback we receive, the positive feedback received for that program, is possibly more than all other programs put together. And it's just so heartening to see. So what you were saying, I totally resonated with it. In fact, we received 3 videos today, and I was just watching them 2 hours ago today before recording this. My team was showing. One person said he lost 7 kilograms of body weight. Another person said that person lost 10 kilograms of body weight by just walking. And so now what they do is they wait for the next walk to weight loss program, which launches on the 1st of every month. And so I totally resonate with you that it just takes small pieces of information and these actionable pieces to start implementing your life, so instead of just looking at improving the 0.01% what others are doing at the Olympics level or not, and it may just not even be applicable to us, for example.
Yeah, and most people, I don't think, realize they would never want that. You know, they're literally training all day, 7 days a week. You know, like it is truly not only a full-time job, but like 120% of your effort type job. And most people want, that isn't their priority. They don't want to sit, you know, you wake up in the morning, immediately worry about what you're eating, immediately worry about what you're training, going to a training center, doing rehab, then actually doing your performance tools, dot, 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 dot. It's 24/7. It's nonstop. And I'm familiar with that with a few individuals I know who are doing elite level athletic endeavors. It is nonstop. And a lot of people just want to feel better. It's a simple step in the right direction. I love that you guys are working to just try and get that, encourage people to take that first step and take multiple steps. There's plenty of research that says that going out and getting more steps every single day has profound implications on cardiovascular health and overall mortality. And you know, the number that a lot of people focus on is, you know, 10,000 steps. But truly, if you go from 2,000 steps, which is average for sedentary individuals, and you start moving to 3, 4, 5, or you go from 2000 to 2001, 2000 to 2002, and you're making progress, that's progress. Progress is progress. And people should just shoot to make, take that first step and then continue to take more and more steps.
Agree. Sorry, not to digress, but come back to the point of where we started, type 1 diabetes in athletes. Let's take an example. If an athlete gets diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and the person is an endurance athlete, how should they be looking at their life of training and living going forward?
This is something I think for a lot of your audience probably won't have type 1, but some probably will. In type 1 diabetes, you no longer have endogenous insulin production. So you basically are losing this automatic thermostat for when glucose goes up. Let's say the body releases insulin, immediately comes down. If glucose goes low, it shuts down insulin release and brings glucose back up. All these mechanisms around insulin being arguably the most potent hormone in metabolism in the entire body, is no longer produced or almost completely absent in people with type 1 diabetes. So what people with type 1 have to do is they have to manually check glucose levels 24/7 at every single meal of every single day, or use continuous glucose monitors. I have one on the back of my arm here, and make decisions about the amount of food, how much carbohydrates, how much protein, how much is going to elevate my glucose levels, and then the 40 or 50 other factors in life that affect insulin sensitivity and the absorption of that insulin into circulation. There is a tremendous amount that goes into what should someone do with type 1 diabetes. And what I have been so passionate about on a personal level, but also as a researcher, is how do you apply nutritional tools that we've talked about that might help improve the life of someone with type 1 diabetes as they're trying to find out how to be, you know, to exercise and be safer, or how would you go about, you know, trying to eat this food versus that food. And so there's a lot of guidelines around exercise and nutrition right now. Most of those focus on safety when it comes to type 1 diabetes. So, you know, avoiding hypoglycemia, avoiding super high levels of glucose levels. But I think about this a bit differently than a lot of the traditional community does, and that I think that there are ways that we can nutritionally lower the key factors in lifestyle that ultimately cause the biggest fluctuations in glucose levels in the diet, but also it lowers the amount of insulin that we need, because insulin's ultimately the most potent factor in changing glucose levels, at least for causing glucose levels to lower, whereas carbohydrates are the most potent factor in raising glucose levels higher. Well, if you lower both of them, seemingly you would lower a lot of the noise and variability that you have throughout the day. And the evidence certainly seems to suggest that if you were able to lower carbohydrates in the diet, that you would lower the amount of insulin. And then evidence has actually shown this, to get much more stable and tighter glucose levels. Well, the most common concern right now is in type 1 diabetes is around exercise safety and people even doing it at all, because they're concerned about their ability to keep normal and safe glucose levels. Because sometimes people can literally start exercising and drop 100 milligrams per deciliter in a very short period of time. Then these are, you know, nutrition is a key consideration when it comes to that. So when we talk about what should someone do, you can go look up the guidelines right now for what someone should do for exercise performance. It says, you know, keep your blood sugar levels around, you know, above 120 before exercise, you know, have this many carbohydrates if, you know, in this situation versus this situation and not. But I want to think beyond all that and think, how does someone not have that much variability in their life on a daily basis that causes them to have all these fluctuations? And as a result, a lot of that focus on nutrition, because nutrition is arguably and evidence-based, the most potent factor on glycemic levels when it comes to athletic performance. So in a roundabout way, what I'm getting at is we know prescriptive guidelines, but maybe we should rethink those or reconsider them for other nutritional studies that may help people on their journey to try to have safer and healthier exercise in type 1 diabetes.
Awesome. The last question around it, and I guess depending on how much time we get in future, there are so many points that are coming out. I guess I would like to sit down for a much longer conversation, and that would possibly be a series of sorts because I think this is just so important. But for today, the athletes, and I know at least three of them who are marathoners and are type 1 diabetic, and their questions were, when they plan their long runs particularly, how should they, other than having a perceived sense of that the energy levels are going down, how do they, are there any ways that they can figure out where their sugar levels are when they are on a, say, 3 hours run or 4 hours run? Because it is possible that early morning they're running and they do not have an awareness of what's happening within their body because they're performing, they are doing a high effort workout. How should they figure that out if there is any other way? And what are some other ways to be prepared when they are running, for example, to avoid any issues?
Yeah, and so you're actually talking about, and I don't know what the availability of these tools are in India.
It's available.
But there's things called continuous glucose monitors, which if worn, allow you to kind of to get it gives you keen insight into what's happening with your glucose levels, not direct glucose levels, but indirect glucose levels, which are reflections of the blood glucose levels as they reach your tissues. And those are really, really powerful tools for getting insight into how to manage these type of nuanced exercise. Because when someone goes from standard blood assessment meters to actually transitioning to something like a continuous glucose monitor, you get not just a single time point, like pre and post. There's a lot of assumptions what happened in between that. But if you have a continuous glucose monitor, you can actually track at each moment, minute by minute, what's happening over that exercise duration. And let's say that this athlete were to go into this run and they're staying stable and they're coming up a little bit, and all of a sudden they start dipping. In that moment is when they would need to intervene. Or if it repeatedly happens at that time point, maybe they need to make decisions earlier at this point that will allow them to not dip at that level so they can maintain their performance. And so having a tool like that allows them to track over time and ultimately make better decisions around the type of exercise they're consistently engaging in so that they can prevent, let's say, hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia before a run. It also allows them to make decisions around nutrition before that run or during the run to help mitigate the main issues in type 1 diabetes, which are hypoglycemia during a run or getting too high in glucose levels that ultimately start to impair performance.
Perfect. Awesome. I think we are reaching the threshold of our podcast conversation, and I'm also aware that you need to go. For today, I would want for us to close here with the hope that we meet up in future fairly soon. And there are several conversations that I think will be of great value to our listeners. And thank you so much for being with us today.
It was an honor, and I appreciate it. And I would absolutely love to come back on and kind of dive into many more of these topics if your audience is also interested.
That's all for today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did speaking with him. If you are continuing to like our podcast, I would love for you to leave feedback from 1 star to all the way to 5 star, and 5 being the highest. I will speak with you guys next week again. Goodbye for now.